let's bring out our guest, Ray Stanford. How you doing, Ray?
Oh, hello, Martin. It's good to be here.
Yes, Ray. And you don't do too many. When's the last time you did an interview? It was a while ago, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I guess my last one was on the Paracast. I don't know when that was, but I think it's been within the last 6 months or so.
Oh, geez, I thought it was a long time. Here, I just made a fool of myself right off the bat. Anyway, it's been a pleasure. I've talked to you a few times on the phone. Sent me your book, and by the way, that book is available. You have some. It's long out of print, but you have some available, and people can go to our show notes. And down at the very bottom of our show notes, you can see where you can buy it directly from Ray. He'll even sign it for you and send it to you. All that information's there. Ray, you wrote this book a long time ago, and you were there at the site. It's pretty exciting because it's all the way back in 1964. I loved your book. I read it with great enthusiasm, and it really was so well written. And just because it described you behind the scenes in the work you were doing and everything that was happening in J. Allen Hynek and the police office of the military, all this, it was wonderful. Ken, for the listener who has, most people know about the Socorro incident, and there's certainly information everywhere out there about it. But would you mind telling in a nutshell for the person that has never heard about it exactly what happened?
Okay, it's difficult to condense, but basically this was on Friday the 24th of April 1964, and Officer Zamora was following a young man in a car that was speeding and anticipating an arrest. And as he drove south, he saw something up in the sky off to his right, and he heard something simultaneously, a very loud, sustained roar. And he didn't know what in the world this might be, but he wondered. He was in the direction approximately of a dynamite shack, which would be just below some hills off to his right. And so he thought, my gosh, maybe the dynamite shack is blown up. The dynamite is going. I'd better get over there, see if anybody's involved, you know, if there's a danger or a hazard. And let me mention first that just before Officer Zamora saw this thing descending in the sky in the west-southwest, there were some tourists in an old green Cadillac, a man, his wife, and their three boys. The eldest was about 11 or 12 years old, that were driving north, intending to get gas at the Whiting Brothers service station run by a man named Opal Grinder. And they were, as they were going north, they saw a strange object that came across their car, and as the gentleman said later, he thought he was going to lose his radio antenna. And then it went over and over to their left, crossed over their highway to the southwest, and began to descend. Well, then they saw the police officer go off the road, Monty Zamora, and head that direction. These tourists, by the way, no one in Socorro knew that this had happened except people listening to police radio. And so when the Opal Grinder, the service station manager, heard this, he didn't know what to make out of it. It was a strange story about a guy in a really weird craft almost taking the roof off their car. So anyway, Zamora climbed up. He hit the gas trying to go up the slope, and his tires spun. I think he had to make three trials to get up the slope. And when he got to the top, he saw something that pretty well stopped his car. At first, of course, here's a man that had never believed, as he told me, in what he called flying saucers. And even after this, he said he didn't believe in flying saucers. And this one, by the way, was not saucer-shaped, but it was like an elongated egg and ellipsoid. But here this thing was down in the ravine, which he could see stress out the side, but the first gut reaction was, oh, my gosh, there's a car that's overturned down there in the ravine. But then he noticed to his right side of it, as he's looking at it, right beside a creosote bush, two small figures in what he said resembled white coveralls. And we'll go in later about the size, how he described these. But he immediately realized maybe what's happening, I better find out. So he went over to the right and dropped out of sight of, he could no longer see the thing in the ravine, dropped out of sight, came back up and pulled up right to a position that I later measured and stepped off as almost exactly 50 feet from the center of where it was landed. That's where he parked his car, right up on top of the slope. And various things happened. He communicated with the police again, but he got out, And he took, I think it was about 3 steps, you'd have to check the book for details, and suddenly there was what he thought initially was an explosion. He'd been in the military and trained, when you have an explosion, hit the ground in a prone position, face down, belly down. And this incredible ground-shaking, body-shaking roar began, and he hit the ground, and he was relieved when he heard it continue, that it was not an explosion. But he then began to look back, and he saw that there was the thing was rising off the ground. And it took 6 seconds to get to the place where it stopped for a moment. And it had a blue-white flame that right where it was striking the ground, there was this light orangish glow around the edges. But what struck him, and really puzzled him, in fact, because he'd seen rocket launchers at White Sands, was the seeming lack of violence of this brilliant blue flame to the ground. He expected that there would be dirt or gravel, sand, flying up at him, but nothing of the sort happened. He said there might have been a little dust, but he thought that was probably because of the high wind that was coming out of the west or the southwest, which is the direction really that it took off in, right into the wind. But he got up and began to run, and he kept looking back because this was an incredible sight to see. He had his glasses on, I would stress, and he saw on the side of it a red symbol, insignia, whatever you want to call it. And we'll talk about that later and the controversy that arose connected with it. But he, in watching this, he ran into the back bumper of his car and kind of jarred himself, knocked his glasses off, but he was not about to stop to pick them up. He went on and ran on past the car, getting it between him and the object in case it still exploded. But when the flame cut off, he heard what he described as a wind down sound, kind of a turbine wind down like sound. And just with incomplete silence, it took off horizontally, going across toward the Perlite Mill, if I remember correctly, check the book, that's about a mile. And it just went horizontally, and it passed, from his position at least, over the steel dynamite shack and went right on. When it got over near the Perlite Mill, it suddenly and steeply angled upward, not vertically, but pretty close to vertical. And as it was going away into the sky, and it got turned, of course, at that position where he's just seeing it from the end on, kind of circular-like. But Chavez, the state police sergeant, Samuel Chavez, drove up, and although he stated publicly that he didn't see it, police officers in Zamora and Socorro that were friends of his told me that he said that he saw this going away as just a little round dot disappearing at incredible speed, climbing up steeply into the sky. But anyway, when Chavez arrived, Zamora had already started wandering back down into the ravine to see what the heck this thing had done. But he was in a real state of shock. Chavez said when he got out of his car, he knew Lonnie quite well on a daily contact basis. He said, Lonnie's not normally a pale face, but he said he was ashen. His face was just white, and he had cold sweat all over his face. And Zamora came back and asked him to accompany him down there. He was a little shaken, more than a little, in fact. And when they got down there, Chavez noted the 4 landing gear imprints, and other officers arrived shortly, and they all saw that there was something rather strange. The bush that had been hit by this exhaust in landing and takeoff, apparently, half of it was missing, but the rest of it was not charred. It was not as if there were this hot, if you had a rocket flame there, heat transfer through the atmosphere would have been great enough that the rest of this bush would have been scorched, but it was not. And Zamora had felt only the slight heat. And this means that something quite extraordinary was involved in the takeoff and landing. In the book, I speculated about the possible source. People had said to me, Ray, don't you think that's a plasma rocket? No, it couldn't have been. If it had been a plasma rocket, there would have still been bounced off. It would have bounced off the surface, and it would have knocked up gravel or sand from the ravine bottom in various directions. Nothing like that happened. And I therefore hypothesized that it was a device which was accelerating subatomic particles to relativistic velocities. Einstein showed that if you accelerate a particle as you approach the speed of light very close to it, it will increase mass. And I believe that this could have been a subatomic particle engine that is accelerating these things. As a result, only where the particles hit would it possibly disintegrate anything. Otherwise, there would not be a lot of heat, exactly as we saw. And later, when the Air Force got Mary G. Mays there to take plant samples and analyze them, she herself was very fascinated with the fact that one half of the bush is missing, and the stems that are there are black, but the rest of it still has its leaves and is not scorched. This almost proves that it had to be a very exotic exhaust. Well, I'm going to step into this account here, and let me first say that immediately after Chavez's arrival, senior patrolman Ted V. Jordan arrived in his car with Under Sheriff James Lucky in the car with him, and they too saw Zamora had, being a very good police officer and a very good observer, as soon as this was over with and he could get back to his car and with a feeling of safety, he tore a piece off of a paper bag and drew the symbol which he had seen on the side of the object in red. Mm-hmm. And contrary to the popular rumor, and I'll explain how that came about later, it was an inverted V with three lines across it. It was not an arc with an arrow under it and a line under that. And not only did Chavez see this, but Ted Jordan and Lucky saw this, and other policemen that came later saw this, and they all described to me the same thing. It was not until the next day that they began to get concerned, and the day after that, about what had happened. The FBI agent who quickly came to the site, Arthur Burns, he made an interesting comment. He told Zamora, "If I were you, I wouldn't talk about those two little figures you saw beside the craft." And Lonnie was a little hesitant to talk about them for quite a while after that, because Burns requested this of him, or suggested it strongly. And after all, he was an FBI agent. Zamora had a lot of respect for government agents, as you'll see, because Burns had called to come to Socorro the up-range commander of White Sands, the integrated Holloman White Sands Range. His name was Richard T. Holder, Captain Richard T. Holder. And he got in there a little while after. Yet he didn't arrive immediately, but what he did, he had Zamora go. They met, they went to the police station and went into a closed-door interview that, even though Holder had a full day on the job with the Army, it lasted until around 1 o'clock in the morning, according to Holder's notes. And standing there with them the whole time was the FBI agent. And what happened here is that Holder suggested to Lonnie Zamora that it might be, well, if he did not describe the symbol in red, or whatever it was, insignia, if you want that term, on the side of the thing, and that they might come up with a substitute one. So that was done, and after that, Zamora began to describe the arc with the arrow in the middle of it vertically and a line underneath it.
Ray, can I just ask you a question here? Why, if they were going to change the symbol, and I understand it's just like any forensic type of investigation or a crime investigation where they don't give out specific factors, because they want to make sure the next person has it right. Why did they even bring it up at all that there was any insignia?
Because Zamora had told people there was. He had drawn it. And the police officers saw it, and they were talking to people about it. But Holder was a good intelligence man. As you may know, sometimes this is done in police work. It released a little bit of misinformation, so the person comes along and tells a story. They throw in the misinformation, you don't have to listen to them. But if they have the right information despite the misinformation, you better pay attention to them. So Holder had a smart move there, and Zamora understood this. By the way, he was an intelligent, highly objective observer, and he agreed to this. And he kept that agreement the rest of his life.
Wow.
And I took big flack from everybody, from Richard Hall and a lot of others, saying, well, I was just making a lot of noise here, that they had called Zamora 2 weeks after the thing or 10 days afterward, and he said it was an arc with an arrow and a line, so it had to be. But I knew that was wrong, so I gave a strong hint of it in my appendix of my book. But quite serendipitously, and 50 years later, almost 50 years later, I got an email from Captain Richard T. Holder, Jr., K Captain Holder's son. And he said, I've been seeing the flak you have taken because you said that what Zamora was reporting after my dad talked to him was not the real symbol. He said, I want to tell you you're correct. My dad told me that he asked Zamora to change it, and Zamora agreed. And I have, and I've published, and you have, I don't know if you posted it, but I have a signed statement from Richard Holder telling about the fact that what his father did, and that indeed what Zamora was showing was not the real symbol. But he kept his word. He felt he was doing the government a favor, I would think, and he was that kind of man, and he kept his word to the end of his life. And someone had said on one internet gossip site, said Ray claims he had a special relationship with Zamora, that Zamora told him the real symbol. That's hogwash. He never told me the real symbol, ever. In fact, I have a drawing he made for me of the arc with the arrow and the horizontal line early on. Of course, this was early on, not years later, after he saw my book. But anyway, I learned this because I paid attention to what the police officers told me, the first arrivers, and they saw what he drew. And let me point out, the book gives a very graphic word-for-word description of what happened in the dispatcher's office when I talked with various policemen coming in there after it had gotten out that Zamora was saying that it was the arc with the arrow, which was not the real symbol. All the policemen were very upset. What they were upset not with Lonnie. They knew that the government had asked him. And you read a very accurate description of this in the book, my talk with Lonnie Zamora. And when I talked to him in that first visit, right before I left Socorro, he didn't want to tell me. He said he had said he would, but he said, "No, I don't think that I can talk to you about it yet." But anyway, it's now all out in the open. And furthermore, as far as the question of an inverted V with three lines, you have kindly posted on your website the letter that Dr. Alan Hynek wrote, the Air Force official investigator there, that he wrote to the Foreign Technology Division at Wright Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Ohio, and that was written on September 7th, 1964. And he was sending them an old advertisement from a new upstart company that was trying to find employees that never did become a really big company and get into aerospace much. They got into making photo cells, but to generate electricity from the cells, but they never got anything big, but they were advertising, and they used a symbol that was vaguely like the Socorro thing, like an inverted V, but it was black and totally different. It had a world in the center of it, or a circular symbol, and really wasn't the same thing, but Hynek sent it to the Air Force because he knew they were desperately trying to find some terrestrial source for this object that they could pin it on. See?
So that's why there was so much talk about that symbol. Ray, can we just, in a second, I want to wind it back just a little bit. I want to ask you about the humanoids, but can you tell the audience how long it was before Hynek showed up, and then how long was it till you showed up on the scene?
Okay. Hynek showed up. Hynek showed up, I think it was about, it was late in the day. I think it was even slightly after nightfall on the 28th of April.
So 4 days after.
That's correct. No, well, yes, the 28th. It was, and I arrived about, I think it was 2 hours after Hynek's arrival.
Oh. Really? Wow.
And that was a very fortunate situation. Hynek knew me from years back in 1959, corresponding about important UFO, two simultaneous daylight movie films of a so-called mothership type thing with smaller objects on July 20, 1959. And we'd corresponded extensively with it, and so he knew me. So when Lonnie strolled into the dispatcher's office at a break in the interview with Hynek, I spoke to him, and I said, "Well, please tell Alan Hynek that Ray Stanford's here." He said, "Oh, you know Alan Hynek?" And I said, "Yes." Well, he told him, and wonderful thing happened. Next morning, there was a closed session with Hynek, Chavez, and Zamora, of course, primary witness, at the site, and nobody was allowed out there. But when I got there at the police station, I asked him if he couldn't communicate with them, and see if I could come out, and Chavez got on the phone and said, "Absolutely not, this is a closed session with Dr. Hynek." Hynek got on the phone, took over the microphone, and said, "Tell Ray Stanford to come on out, just don't bring anybody else with him." So that's how I got in on the initial interview. And what happened as a result of that is very important, related to the press conference that Hynek had immediately after our visit to the site there. And do you have a question or anything here, or should I go ahead and tell what happened there about the occupants at the site?
No, you can go ahead quickly on that, and we'll just get back to the occupants.
Okay. The occupants, we stood there, and Zamora was standing right beside the bush where he saw the one. There were two occupants. One was a little further to the west, and one was nearer to him. And the nearer one was the one that had jumped. Like, he turned around and saw Zamora's car, probably heard it, the gravel he was throwing up as it came up the slope, and then looked over there. Zamora got up at the top. And look, Zamora said it jumped as if it were startled. But I quizzed him, as you see the verbatim record of it in the book, about what size were these two beings or whatever they were. And he took his hand and he held it under a certain limb of the creosote bush that was right there by the Northwest Landing Gear imprint. And he said, well, his head came right under here. And he told us that they were the size of a young child, maybe a 10-year-old child. They were quite small, and both of them that size. And so there was no disputing. He saw that he didn't say they were white coveralls. He said they were things in what resembled white coveralls, a good objective description. And when we got to Hynek's press conference a little later, I guess it was 1 o'clock, after our in-depth interview there at the site, Hynek completely denied that Zamora had ever told him he saw any occupants at all. And you can read in the book he mentioned something that had a resemblance to white coveralls beside the instrument or device. Notice not even using the term craft or object, instrument or device. This reduced it to something very strange. But anyway, he lied right there, even though I had been at the site with him within 20 minutes before, and Zamora had described the height of these and told exactly what they, how they acted and how the one had jumped. And here he was saying that Zamora never described occupants to him.
Well, we're if you're listening live, we're talking to Ray Stanford, and you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com, pose a question or two. And so moving on, the part that struck me the most was the actual physical evidence. Who was the first to notice that?
Well, let me put it this way. We were standing there, and I was watching the time for Hynek's press conference at 1 o'clock. And Zamora, I noticed that he was kept bending down and kind of looking over at the Northwest Landing Gear imprint, which we'd been standing by because he's got the occupants who were standing there. And finally, he bent on further down. He says, well, you'd have to see the exact quote in the book, but he said something like, it looks like the landing foot, I believe he used the term foot, must have scraped the edge of this rock. You see where it looks like it's broken. And, this clicked with me, and I wondered what Hynek was going to say. Immediately, I realized this was a volcanic rock with some quartz crystals in it, small quartz crystals. It should have scraped almost any kind of metal that had been rubbing down against it. And this occurred to me, here's probably some metal. But Hynek merely said, yes, a heavy object might do that. That's all he said. And so then I said, well, and you don't want to be late to your press conference. Maybe we better get on up there to the motel. And so we went, and so they wouldn't suspicion that I was thinking anything about what might be on their rock, I jumped in my VW Bug and took off ahead of them and headed for the motel. But when it was over and Hynek was being chauffeured back to Albuquerque for his flight home by the Air Force, and by the way, at the press conference, he said he was here investigating this on his own, had nothing to do with the Air Force. He was just here on his own. Totally false. 100%. And documents prove it, and I have them in my files. But anyhow, this was a fascinating thing to see that at the press conference, within 20 minutes of our conversation at the site, he would say that Zamora never described documents to him.
Wow. Now, by the impressions themselves, they can actually tell the approximate weight of the vehicle by that, can't they?
That's right.
And what do they come up with on that?
Well, even though, unfortunately, penetrometer measurements were not made, no one used a penetrometer there to detect the real compactability, some pretty good educated guesses were made. And I don't remember the exact figure, but off the top of my head, you'll find it in the book. But I think it was, I may have been 10 to 20,000 pounds. I'm not sure. Check the book, not my memory after 50 years. But basically, a physicist friend of mine looked at the estimated weight, and then he calculated the volume from Zamora's description of the body of the object, and taking in for a little extra weight for the landing legs and gear. And he came up with the fact that based on the penetration, that it was within a reasonable density range for conventional aircraft. It was a little heavier than a conventional aircraft would be, but it was within a reasonable range of that. So the thing that he pointed out was that the landing gear had pushed down. They had not dug out. They weren't dug out. They were clearly pushed down into the ravine soil, and then as they pulled out, some of the dirt was that it had come back over them after getting out of the way of the landing gear. Some of it fell back in, but some was pulled to the side. And everybody noted, Chavez was the first to note this, and it impressed him, that you could see the difference in the light reflectivity, that you could tell that the soil was moist where it had been down in there and pulled out, that it was fresh, where it contrasts with the rest of the soil in the ravine was lighter color because it had less moisture. And so that was an important observation for Chavez to absolutely let him know that the thing had just been there and taken off. Now, you'd ask me about the rock itself. I went back after the media conference, and I got the rock.
You snuck back there, really, right? Like at night when everyone was gone?
No, it wasn't at night, no.
Oh,
no,
okay.
The conference, I think the conference was at 1 o'clock, if I remember correctly, and by, I forget the exact time, but around 2 o'clock, it was over with, and I made speed back there because it looked like it was threatening rain, and when I got out of sight, there was a little mist, and then for a moment, the clouds cleared, and I got that nice photograph that you kindly posted on your blog site of the landing gear with the rock in it. I have a picture also that I didn't send, but after I removed the rock from it, but I documented that it was there, and then I documented that it had been removed. And it was not ever, I did not take a look at this until I wrapped it carefully in some newspapers and put it under my Volkswagen seat, and it was not until I got back to Phoenix that I took a look at it, because I needed to get back. It was a 400-mile drive, and I wanted to get back, and preferably before nightfall. And so I, on my way back, I got really sidetracked because I had my own sighting of a UFO, and I got two pictures of it in broad daylight, and it was moving north to south. I was 22 miles west don't quote me, it's in the book. But anyway, I was quite a ways west of Socorro, and this thing flew across, and it was a rather impressive sight, and I won't go into the amazing details we found later when in recent years I was able to enlarge the movie slides, ectochrome slides, and see some quite remarkable facts about this object. But what I want to bring up is that when I finally got where I could get to a telephone, I called Walter Schrode of Radio KSRC Socorro, who had been the first one to broadcast about this event, and I told Walter about it, and I was kind of hoping that he would broadcast and say, did anybody else see this? But he didn't, and as he told me, he just decided not to. But while after I had called him, some people came into the radio station. They said, we're listening to you driving into Socorro, and we have to tell you about what we saw. We were driving east, and we saw this object going from south to north across the highway. Well, they gave him the exact same time that I gave him, except they were west of me. They were west of its course, and I was east of its course. And they described it, as you said, exactly the same, with the shimmering blue back end, the back half of it. It was kind of elongated thing, but the back half of it was a shimmering blue light around it. And they described it exactly the same way. So Schrode was pretty impressed. The fact that he hadn't described anything, hadn't asked for witnesses, and this couple just came in and told this to him spontaneously. So that's this. You can see how this sidetracked me a little bit until I got to Phoenix and got in good sunlight and opened up and saw this marvelous metal that I thought that you can't imagine the thrill that, that I had when I saw that.
Oh, absolutely. That's to me, was one of the most exciting parts of the book. And I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I want to jump back to talk about Lonnie. Did you ever have a conversation with Lonnie where he would say that, I wish I'd never said anything about this? Did he ever have that feeling?
He never said that to me.
Never said it to you. Because I know that he went through I know that he was frustrated because of all the attention he was getting, and he didn't want it. You know what I mean? Is that a good assessment?
Yes, and his wife is a very nice person, and his daughter. And let me amplify what you said with this little story. Before I moved up here 27 years ago, I was still living in Austin and had my operation down there for electronic and optical tracking of UFOs. I got a letter from Lonnie Zamora's daughter, and she gave me information to conclusively prove that she was his daughter. And she said, you know, I was 4.5 years old when this happened. And she said, as you said in your book, she was, I think, at the time 21 or 22 when she wrote me. And she said, my dad, you said he was a closed-mouthed man. Yes, he is to this day. She said, he doesn't want to talk about this, never did want to talk about it, didn't ever want it to have happened to him. She said, so when I turned 21, and she asked me to call her on the phone, and we had a really nice conversation for about an hour. And she said, you know, I said, Dad, look, I'm 21. Okay, I was 4.5 years old when this happened, but would you tell me now what happened? And he said, no, you know, I don't want to talk about it. He said, you see that big box over there, that big corrugated box? He said, there's all kinds of articles written on this, and there's all kinds of letters from everybody and their dog. He said, no matter what article you read, you'll find out that the truth is only one person got it accurate. That's Ray Stanford. It's that book over there. It's a coral saucer on the shelf. If you want to find out exactly what happened, Ray is the only person that got it right. And so that's why she contacted me. And she said, and what I want to know, too, have you learned anything more about this? And I told her, you know, what subsequently I had learned. So I thought that was a wonderful, heartwarming thing. And after Zamora died of a heart attack a couple of years ago, in November, I wrote a eulogy that was carried pretty broadly on the internet for him, and she wrote me a very sweet letter thanking me for the eulogy. So he has a wonderful daughter, and his wife is a really sweet lady. I know this from talking with James Fox, the producer, who had extensive contact with her a few months ago when he was in Socorro. And she has verified, she said that this completely, it absolutely upset him inside tremendously. It was so beyond anything that he had ever conceived of. And it just really kind of turned. She said he did go to a priest and talk to him about it because he was very, very upset.
Yeah, that really changes everything when you really, you know, see something like that. Let's go back to talking about the rock again. So you have this rock, and this whole story, the way it unfolds, I want you to tell that in great detail about how you brought it to be analyzed. Because you held at, now how old were you in 1964? You were pretty young.
Yes, I was, as of, now in April, of course, I was still 25, but when June came, I was been 26. And the picture that is in the Air Force files of me with Chavez and Zamora that Heinrich took at the side in the Blue Book files, of course, that was, of course, before my birthday, which is in June. So anyway, I had correspondence. I had been authorized by Richard Hall, the late Richard Hall, Dick Hall, to officially investigate this for what they call the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which I'd point out was not a government organization at all, despite the seeming name, the name that might make people think that. And it was just a UFO investigation organization. And he authorized me to investigate for them. So I duly, immediately, as soon as I discovered this metal on the rock, I called Richard and told him about it. And we communicated back and forth. Now, we had a very unfortunate situation, and I take the full blame for this part of it. there were several, I think, the book, I think it mentioned, there were numerous tiny places on the rock where the metal had scraped onto little crystals that were sticking out, but there was three nice rolled-up slivers parallel with each other that had actually rolled up off the metal as it cleaved down the side of the rock by the landing gear imprint. And unfortunately, there was a medical doctor friend of mine that I invited to have a look at this, and instead of leaving it sitting on the table, I picked it up and handed it to him. Hmm. We were standing out in the yard, and he reached and took it right exactly where the slivers were, and all three of those were lost. I mean, at 26, at 25, whatever I was, you don't want to cry, particularly in front of the other guys, but I almost did. I mean, I went and I found a guy with a powerful, powerful magnet, and we, in case it was magnetic, we didn't know what metal was, but we tried to see if we could pick it up. We couldn't find these slivers at all. It was, of course, in the grass and the dirt of the Phoenix, you know, kind of sandy yard there. And we never found them, but at least we still had this on the rock, and so it became much more of a choice, a test to find the right thing to do with this because there was so little of it. Hmm. And eventually, Richard told me that he had been contacted by the person that turned out was the head of the Space Systems Division at Goddard Space Flight Center, Dr. Henry Frankel, and who's deceased now. That's a long story. But he had said that he would be willing to do analysis on this, and Richard said, I believe we can trust him. I went over there, and they showed me their laboratory and all that he named the various analytical systems they had, including X-ray diffraction. So I said, well, okay. I had to be up in Virginia anyway, in that area, as a counselor for a summer camp for kids. And I knew that, of course, I really wanted to do this. And so I said, well, I'll just come right on up, and we'll do this. So we did it, and you can read in my book the tension I went through, even the last moments before you make the final decision, we're going to take this out of Goddard Space Flight Center and analyze this. And but we went out there, and everybody that wants to know the details must read the details in the book because they were carefully recorded in every detail. Now, there was a very interesting thing that this man who was the head of his whole division there, Space Systems Division at Goddard, was a very, to me, incredible man. Richard said he told him that he had once been a big, pretty much a believer in UFOs, but he'd become more skeptical in recent times, but he was looking for more evidence that might resolve the issue. And I said, well, look, I've got something. He said, I don't think the government really knows, you know, what's going on. And I said, well, I think they do to some extent. I said, let me show you something. And I had an album there, and I showed him Joint Army Navy Air Force procedure called JANAP. Two of them, one for radio and telephone, radio telephone description and coded communications, in case they saw objects that might be dangerous to national defense. And one of the things drawn was a distinct Saturn-shaped UFO with streaks behind it indicating making a high-speed reversal of direction. And he was flabbergasted. He said, it's hard for me to believe. Where did you get these? I explained to him where I got them. And he said, look, I'm going to have to check on this. And he was very open and honest. He said, look, I'm not going to tell him. I said, I'm going to call up an admiral friend of mine. Since these are Navy, Army, Navy, Air Force documents, he said he should know about them. And I'm going to put on the speakerphone so you can hear him. And he got this guy on, and the guy said, I can't talk about UFOs. He said, well, you know, let me describe to you a naval document. He said, what naval document? Anyway, the text of the verbatim thing is there. And the guy hears this, and oh, man, he's shocked that he has copies of it, and he admits, okay, yes, they are. And he said, I'm going to talk any more about this. And so that was the end of the conversation. But Dr. Frankel admitted that this really shook his skepticism when he heard this guy who'd known for years, this admiral, confirm this. And I like Dr. Frankel, and I want to say this now. Even though there was a cover-up of the findings later, I believe that he was forced to this. I don't believe he wanted to. So what happened is we took the rock into the laboratory, and we set it under a binocular microscope, which enables you to see things very three-dimensionally. And We all looked at the metal scraped on the rock. We turned the rock around in various positions. It was not pseudo-metallic refraction from quartz crystals, anything like that. It was clearly metal. In fact, you can read in the book which one said this. I forget which one of the... There was two assistants and Dr. Frankel himself there. I forget which one said this. But they commented, and the other one said, yes, it looks that way, that some of the metal looked like the... that it might have been in a slightly molten state when it was smeared onto there, which, of course... These things, if you consider that they might have been folded in toward where this big exhaust was, if it got in the just on the edge of this thing, you might have had some effect like that. I don't know for sure, but that's a possibility. I think there could have been a strong microwave component from if it's the type of engine that I thought it was. Anyway, that's what they thought it looked like. And they said, okay, now we need to get this stuff off the rock, and we'll be putting it over the weekend under radiation. And then on Monday we will do X-ray diffraction test. And I said, wait a minute, I want to make a request. I don't want you to take all of this. And will you promise me just to take half of it? And he said, yes, okay, we'll take only half of it. I said, be sure and leave me the other half. He said, no, you don't go over the cafeteria. It's right across the parking lot there. And that was in Building 2 at Goddard, which no longer exists. They tore it down recently. But anyway, we went to the cafeteria, and I felt very uneasy. Something just told me something was wrong. But when we got back over, and I asked the guy for the rock, and he said, well, it's over there in that place. And so when we got it, there was no metal left on it. And let me tell you, that was one of the low points of my life.
Sure. And you know, I possibly had the most... outstanding evidence ever in your hand.
That's right. Hmm. And guess what? I mean, oh gosh, I can't tell you how it was. And so I immediately said, look, you promised to leave half this. And Richard Hall, you can read the exact verbatim quote in the book. He came in and he says, don't make a scene. Don't make a scene. We may need these people in the future. Don't make a scene. Hey, they just took all of this coral metal and I don't make a scene? I'm sorry, Richard. And, but, you know, so finally, after Richard's protest, and, you know, you're going to cause problems for us, and blah, 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 blah. So I backed out and took the rock and put it back in its canister without the metal on it, and took it back, ultimately, to Arizona. But anyway, let me follow up some. Okay, here's what happened. I went down to the summer camp, and he had told me to call him back on Wednesday. Then on Monday, they would take it out of the radiation, and would using X-ray diffraction. What this does, you on film, you produce you have the actual past pattern of the way the radiation that is re-emitted from the absorption of radiation, as it's re-emitted, it will give you pictures of the crystalline structure, and you can diagnose what the material is by the crystalline structure. And so I called him, and please, everybody, read the exact, this is verbatim recorded in the book, what Dr. Frankel told me. It was totally sincere and forthright, and this will not be verbatim, it's in the book, and I don't like reading from the book, it's kind of boring to read over a radio show. But basically, he said, Ray, he said, I think that you were of the impression that this might be an extraterrestrial object. He said, well, this analysis would tend to support such an interpretation because, and he stressed this, he said, we're the ultimate authority what is and isn't made on Earth in foundries. We have a list of, so far as we know, every foundry. He said, no one could claim to have a better list. We have the list of lists. And he said, this is a zinc iron alloy, and it is not manufactured on any foundry on Earth. He said, so it would certainly lend itself to the extraterrestrial interpretation, if you want to interpret that way, because he said, it is quite strange that we can't find it. And he said, furthermore, it would make a nice corrosion-resistant coating for our landing gear. He actually said that. So that was great, and I was wondering. He said, now, there are a few little tiny traces of elements in there other than the zinc and the iron. He said, for the most part, it's basically all zinc and iron, but they're just tiny traces. He said, we're going to be doing a few more tests here. He said, call me in a week. He said, it'll probably not take nearly that long, but call me. Well, make a long story short, when the week was passed, and I called him, they said he wasn't available. Hmm. Read it in the book verbatim what happened, what I was told. And then the next time, she said, "Well, he's in a security conference. He cannot talk to you. He's in a security conference." I wonder, wait a minute, what's going on? Well, here's what I believe happened. I then finally, after keeping calling, I finally, one of his assistants out of the lab called me and said, Dr. Frankel is no longer involved. I have called to give you the, now get this, Dr. Frankel said, this is all being done before the analysis was done, unofficially. I can't justify expenditure officially, but it's being done unofficially, you see. Okay, well, this guy calls me, and he's named in the book. He tells me, Dr. Frankel is no longer involved, which is an interesting statement in itself. And he said, I have called to give you the official conclusion. It was all a mistake. All we analyzed, was, we just saw it on the thing. It was just a refraction from quartz crystals. It's silica dioxide. Well, I knew immediately. I knew about X-ray diffraction and that that had to be false. So as soon as I got off the phone, I called Dr. P.E. Smith, head of the Department of Chemistry at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi. And I said, I didn't want to give him a loaded statement. So I said, look, I'm not going to tell you what this is about, but it's just some metal that I took to Goddard and they analyzed. And they said it was, with X-ray diffraction, that it was a zinc iron alloy. And then I told him about the mistake they claimed they made, and it was silica dioxide. And he said, well, you know, I don't know the situation, but he said either they were lying to you or they were intoxicated or something, because that's impossible. Well, let me switch forward to Alan Hynek called me in Phoenix, somewhat later, he says, Ray, I want you to, if you would like to, attend my address to the Northwest University Founders Day reception of the big resort here north of Phoenix today at noon. I said, I'd be delighted. And so when we got together, he said, well, Ray, he said, what did you find out from Dr. Frankel at Goddard about the metal that was scraped on the rock? Well, interesting. I had never told him. But he knew it was Dr. Frankel. And I said, well, and I told him exactly as I just told him. I said, that's what they claimed, that it was all okay. He said, Ray, look. He said, if I were you, just forget the disclaimer. He said, I know about this kind of analysis. And he said, that mistake could not have happened. Just accept the original statement and forget the rest of it. And I believe my personal take on it, I can't prove it scientifically, is that Dr. Frankel was totally sincere and he would love to have told me and given me a confirmation of this. But I believe it had to be taken, and he had said, you know, if there's something important, we'll have to take it. I didn't use the word upstairs, but to the authorities and you know, they'd have to get permission to make a statement anyway. And so I believe they told him, hey, you can't confirm this to him. This is important. You can't talk about it. And I think he did not want to lie to me, and he didn't want to tell me that. And I think he was the kind of man and a very honest man that didn't want to. Now, I'll add very quickly the most remarkable, strange, the world, the universe is very strange. That was 1964. Years later, I came up here from Texas and I married a lady that worked at Goddard Space Flight Center, and I'm still married to her, my wonderful wife, Sheila. And at some point when I came here, she worked at the visitor center, but eventually she got to, she would transfer to a better job in public affairs. And for the second time since this had come out, and I published this in the book, there was a big publicity flap about this and about the cover-up at Goddard. So guess what? Freedom of Information Act request came in to public affairs, and guess whose desk they came to? Sheila Stanford's desk.
How about that? Hey, listen, you know, we only have about 3 minutes left, Ray.
Okay.
And I know we're going to do an extended version, so the live listener, if you want to check out the podcast after about an hour time, tomorrow you'll hear the extended version. And, you know, before we sign off for the live show, and that's less than 3 minutes, you mentioned that there was some new things that happened, and keep in mind, you only have a couple minutes. Is there anything you can tell the listener right now?
Oh, well, Sheila said there's a conflict of interest. I can't take this, and you passed it to others who said they couldn't find any record of it, of course. But, yes, there are a number of things, one of which is I believe that I have uncovered the reason, and a very good one, why suddenly on Sunday, the third day after the event, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the FBI agent and government authorities with a radiation detector and the analyst for plant materials showed up at the Socorro site. And it had to do with the fact that the film that Patrolman Jordan had taken was radiated and was damaged by radiation. The Air Force had discovered this. They'd gotten it from him, taken this, discovered it, and said they better go out there and check for radiation, I'm sure. And I have some interesting things I could say in the extended session about that.
Okay, we'll move on in that. So for the live listener right now, you can check out again. Our podcast will be up tomorrow for the rest of it. And Ray, for the live listener, why don't we say goodbye? Okay, welcome back. This is the extended version with Ray Stanford. And Ray, what other things, what other involvement did Hynek have in this whole situation?
Well, it was quite interesting because he returned to Socorro on the 15th of August, 1964. And in the official files of Blue Book, he comments to the Foreign Technology Division that he told them the story. He said, "My story was that I just happened to be traveling through," which wasn't true. He was absolutely there on a mission. And anyway, he came into town. He had certain more things he wanted to check on and to see if the Morris story had changed or if he wanted to say anything more than he'd said before and so on. And but Zamora was loaded with a question. You see, I came into town on the 26th of August, and a few days after that, and when I went by to see Ronnie Zamora, who had agreed to give me a statement about the metal scraped onto the rock, about the rock, pointing out the rock that was broken there, I found the metal, and subsequently, and so Ronnie said, you know, he said, Patrolman Jordan, is New Mexico State Policeman Jordan, is quite upset. They took his film that Friday night. He took the pictures immediately, frankly, after the thing took off. And they took his film, told him they'd give it back to him after they copied it, and he never it was never returned. So he asked me to ask Hynek, if I ever saw Hynek again, what happened to his film and why it wasn't returned. So when Hynek came into town on the 15th, Zamora asked him. And he said, well, you can tell Officer John that the Air Force could not return his film because it was damaged, seemingly fogged as though by radiation, and it looked like this effect might give clue to an exotic propulsion system, and they could not afford to get the film back. And that's what he told Jordan, and Jordan gave me a signed affidavit confirming that. Well, I decided to confront Hynek. I only had the word from Zamora and from Ted Jordan that Zamora had told him what Hynek told him. So when Hynek was visiting Austin, our office headquarters down in Austin, there had been a news crew in from Houston that had taped me regarding our field activities with our instruments and for tracking UFOs. And I had asked them if they'd do me a favor and would record for me an interview with Dr. Hynek. So we set out in chairs in front of the big, nice new office building. We had offices there. And I confronted Alan with what Zamora had told me and that I had an affidavit from Ted Jordan about this. And he confirmed yes. That is what the Air Force told him. Now, here is the guy that was the chief scientific consultant to the Air Force Project Blue Book. Going on, this is a television picture of him in high quality, confirming that the Air Force said that it was radiated. Well, it didn't dawn on me until a little later when I was writing the book that there's a connection. The film was taken Friday night, and they would have to have a little time to develop it and take a look at it. But that was Friday. Maybe it was processed Saturday morning. They took a look at it on Saturday. But all of a sudden, suddenly, not on Friday night, not on Saturday morning or Saturday any time during the day, but on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, the FBI agent and Major Connor and another Air Force officer from Wright Patterson and the lady who did the analysis, Mary G. Mays, and Zamora showed up at the site with the radiation instruments, checking for radiation. Why all of a sudden after this time? Normally, you would, if you had some radioactivity you want to check, you'd check it right away. Mm-hmm. Why all of a sudden, taking everybody out of their normal home activities of rest on Sunday at 4 o'clock, getting them out there at the site, and it was quite cool and windy. You can see Mary Mays is holding her arm. She's shivering. And Why? Well, I believe it's because they found the effect of the radiation and they wanted to see it was not still there. It's very important, the fact that they said they didn't get much radiation. Well, this is to be expected. Let's analyze it. I had projected, I had theorized that we were dealing with subatomic particles having effective propulsive mass because they were accelerated to relativistic velocities near the speed of light. Well, these particular kind of these particles at these speeds hitting the matter in the ravine bottom would create isotopes. However, most of the isotopes would be extremely, if not all of them, extremely short half-life, theoretically, and therefore they would drop off very rapidly. But Ted's film, Officer Ted Jordan's film, was taken almost immediately, within 5 or 10 minutes after the thing flew away. But the next morning, Sergeant Chavez, New Mexico State Police, took pictures with his Polaroid, and there was no problems. Well, if this was what I think it was, that might well be expected. And in fact, there's a professor professor of advanced mathematics. I'm forgetting exactly what he teaches at a university in New Mexico. That's the state director for MUFON there, Don Burleson. He has several times given papers on this since he saw my report on this about how, what kind of isotopic situation we could see in this situation, and the very fast drop off. And I think it's an extremely telltale fact that they showed up at 4 Sunday afternoon. So that is a very exciting thing, and I'm also excited about the possibility. James Fox has said, I'll believe it when they asked me directly for the videotape, but he said they badly want to use this in the film because this is a major, major thing. The head of the Air Force investigation, Dr. Heine, actually saying that this film was irradiated, and that it appeared that it might give clues to advanced propulsion. So here we have a very, very important item that I hope that they will be using in the film because of its importance to this whole case. And it's certainly not something that anybody could have faked.
Right. Now, I want to go back to, I want to ask you a question later on, but I don't want to forget this question, I'll put it that way. And that is, I want to talk about your UFO tracking equipment eventually, but to stay on track with this right here, you just talked about that this could not be faked. I want to talk about the people that are kind of, well, I don't want to use any bad terms, but they really have made up these silly stories about this being a hoax, and completely falls apart.
Right.
I want to talk about the professor, and I also want to talk about the person that claims that NASA had this helicopter drop in something and pull it out, and there are people in white uniforms and all that stuff.
Oh, boy.
So let's talk about the hoax, the people that claim the hoaxes.
Okay, now this is a claim that it was a student hoax of New Mexico Tech students. And it is not only without basis, but it is totally false from beginning to end. It began with idle speculation by a closed-minded Sterling Colgate. You see, when this began, Walter Schroeder of Radio KSRC in Socorro, who is a guy who did all the radio interviews, which some of which you've heard, with Zamora, and the night that was there on the night of the 28th, I believe it was that night. Anyway, we went over to have something to eat, and we saw two ladies there that started telling us about, they had both heard the roar on landing and the roar on takeoff. But Schroeder told me, he said, you know, it's kind of funny. I went over to the university today, and he talked to Sterling Colgate, and he said, what do you think about this report, this thing that said it happened down there that Zamora saw? And he said, well, obviously it's a student hoax. And he said, what do you mean? He said, it doesn't sound like a student hoax to me. And he said, well, it has to be. He said, why do you say that? Do you know somebody that created a hoax? He said, no, I don't know anybody. But he said, it has to be. It had to be? He said, yes. He said, otherwise, I mean, there's nothing to be coming here from the stars. It's too far away. Nobody can make the trip. Mm-hmm. So it has to be, have an explanation. The explanation, we're at college town. These kids, you know, they play stunts sometimes. They must have done this. Ignoring the fact that
this is what he based his whole argument on. Is that
that's all it was ever based on. And then years later, you see, Linus Pauling wrote him, knowing that he had been there at the university at that time, and he said, "Well, what do you think about the thing that said happened in Socorro?" And he said, "Oh, it's student hoax." And so you know who takes this up and says, woohoo, I've got the proof, this is the Student Hoax. Well, the truth of the matter is, not one element of the story fits what really happened and what all the witnesses described. I mean, there were all kinds of witnesses. I mean, these students could not have flown a craft in over this car and had to take the roof off of it.
Didn't they say something about they had this film up, or I mean, this projector screen up or something? Did I hear something about that?
Oh, I don't know anything about that, but I can tell you, I mean, the whole thing is so ludicrous. Let's take this from the start. Okay, we have to posit that these students were psychic. Yeah, they knew exactly how Zamora was going to react. They knew Zamora was going to be chasing this speeder, so they had this speeder. Well, I happen to have the name of the speeder, and I know what his name was, and he was not a student. He was not engaged in a hoax. A young kid, and there was no hoax involved. They could not have made this thing. I mean, people saw it flying. There was a report to the radio station that the guy, I think there were two of them in the car, saw this thing flying down towards the coral from Albuquerque. Then it almost took the thing off the car. Okay, then it has to come in and land. Then it has to have two occupants beside it. Then in 6 seconds, it has to turn on this flame. Well, in the first place, it was claimed, well, this was a hot air balloon. He shows this stupid little tiny hot air balloon there as proof of this. This had to be a hot air balloon. Sorry. A hot air balloon, you have to have a flame underneath it. The flame goes upward into the bag to create the heat. This flame was going downward into the ground, making a terrible roar. And by the way, I have been right beside, and in fact have ridden in a hot air balloon, make the kind of roar that Zamora described at all.
Yes, I've been in one.
And in 6 seconds, they have to land it in this high-speed wind. There was a wind up to 40 knots out of the southwest at that time. You have to bring it in into this wind from the east against the wind and land it. Then you have to have it in 6 seconds, fire up and take off with its exhaust going down into the ring instead of up into the bag, and there was no bag. It was not shaped like a hot air balloon. It was exactly like the drawing in my book, a long ellipsoid. Impossible. And furthermore, they were girders. And it took off in 6 seconds, had folded these things up, and took off in total silence after the roar, and there was the hum sound, the turbine winding down, some more sound, when the roar cut off. And it flew across to the perlite mill directly into the wind, and then angled up almost vertically and disappeared in a very short time. Calculations have been done by an engineer in California, and he concluded that, knowing the actual size of it, the Moore said it was, to become invisible to the eye in that amount of time, it had to have become supersonic. And there was not any sonic boom. We know UFOs don't produce sonic booms. And this thing didn't either if it was going supersonic. Anyway, there's no way you can get that performance out of a hot air balloon. No way you can make it look like what Zamora saw. And furthermore, let's go back to this completely asinine thing, this total fiction that a helicopter is bringing in this. Why are they bringing in this cylinder from White Sands to bring it down by a dynamite shack in Sequoia? It's absolutely crazy. And furthermore, there was no sound of any helicopter. Nobody saw a helicopter. They would have you believe that this Latino, this wonderful man, who the famous tracker of meteorites that had taken a report from Zamora about the trajectory of one of the meteorites he was trying to track and find on the ground, Lincoln La Paz, he said that Zamora's report to him was as accurate as anyone had ever given him. He said he is an extremely accurate observer, and I know this. Zamora was so objective. You could not, no matter what you said, he embellished nothing, as hoaxers usually do. Mm-hmm. He was totally objective. He wouldn't even say that these were coveralls. He said in what resembled white coveralls. Mm-hmm. Every word of the man was commendable for its objectivity. And so Chavez, who is a very hard-headed, anti-UFO kind of a guy, who always believed this was some kind of a black project craft, despite the small occupants, he absolutely backed Zamora 100%, and he realized that this man was, he knew what a wonderful policeman he was, and everybody in Socorro, Hynek, I've got copies in my files of the letter, this long letter that Hynek wrote, after his in-depth investigation into the character and intelligence of Zamora. They write these idiots that say, who was a lunar lander, which is totally disproven. The Foreign Technology Division disproved that right away. But I want to say something. They took this so seriously that I'm turn around here and look at my second computer screen here and see at a document that I have up here just for this this purpose. On the on June, I'm trying to get the date here. In June, anyway, early June, just before June 6th, there was. My eyes have been focused on a different screen. Let me get the focus. There was a secret conference at Holloman Air Force Base. This was secret. Now, the documents related to it, trying to get the thing organized, have no secret content. So they were one was classified simply as confidential, and it was later declassified some years later. The other one was unclassified because they did not discuss classified information, but. They talked about a secret meeting that was to occur at Holloman Air Force Base, and it involved, there was a teleconference from a Mr. Sayin, a Captain Weimer, and Captain Quintanilla, of course we know who he was, on June 24, 64, before this conference, which was on July 6. Now, by the way, this Mr. Sayin is mentioned in both documents. Notice he has no rank before his name. Who is this mysterious Mr. Sayin? Well, I can practically assure you, he was with the intelligence community. If they're with the intelligence community, they can use often the last name, but you'll not see a rank. You'll not see anything other than that, simply the simplest form of identification. Anyway, they rendezvoused on the 6th of July, and listen at this. In the communication about planning the conference, it says, get this, Captain Hector Quintanilla, AO 223-1554, will arrive on or about 6 July 64 for meeting with MDC commander. Captain Quintanilla, get this, is cleared up to and including top secret. So here we go. In other words, they wanted to know that everybody had good security clearance before they go to this. The reason was that they were going to try to find out, they wanted to find, as they say in the other letter here, a rational explanation for this. They wanted to try to determine if there was somewhere a black research project that they didn't know about. And that's why it was so secret and held at Holloman. And nobody knew about this until years later when these got declassified. But this is how seriously they took it, and they got zero. As the more, as Captain Quintanilla later told the CIA, absolutely, they could not find anything that could possibly have been there on that day or at any other time in Socorro.
Yeah, one of the things you were talking about this NASA lander there, and why, you're right, why would it go out of White Sands? Because White Sands is huge. There's no reason for it to go off a military base.
Absolutely. It's insane. I mean, I don't know what these people are smoking or drinking or injecting that are making these kind of statements, but this is totally irrational. I mean, my God, you're right. White Sands is huge. And furthermore, the areas where any experiments with flights go on are way even further down in White Sands.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a chance they went up in that area.
Is the name Bragdalia, am I saying the name right?
I'm sorry, what's that?
The name, is it Bragdalia?
Are you calling a person's name?
Yes, the skeptic. The one that was causing a lot of trouble with this whole hoax.
Oh, you mean the one that claimed it was student hoax?
Yes.
Oh, no, his name is Anthony Bragalia.
That's
B-R-A-G-A-L-I-A.
Right. Now, why did he have such he really went at this thing hard. Any idea why he had such a...
You make yourself famous and a hero. You explained the best Close Encounter of the Third Kind case in the world, probably. The one that's most highly regarded, certainly by the United States government, at least by Blue Book. And this is the one that, this was the straw that broke the camel's back with Dr. Hynek. He told me that himself. I mean, he'd seen some things that bothered him. But man, when he met Socorro, when he went to Socorro and he met Zamora, and he then talked to other people, and there were other witnesses, he knew that this was something that he couldn't put into an explanatory box. This is the case, and so this guy who's been in UFOs for a few, he suddenly pops up mysteriously, I don't know out of where, but he suddenly pops up on the scene, And all of a sudden, he starts making incredible claims that nitinol was discovered from the crash at Roswell, that as a result of what they found at Roswell, nitinol was developed. Well, as far as I'm concerned, that, like the other claims that someone else made, that solid state electronics came from there, I don't believe for a minute. But in any case, it is he suddenly comes up, he becomes, in the minds of the skeptics, oh, the great hero has explained Socorro, when not a single of his facts have any relevance to the case. They do not match anything in any way whatsoever.
Now, what was Philip Klass? What was his stand?
Phil Klass?
Yeah.
Well, Phil, of course, the first thing that he claimed was that this was simply a plasma that had escaped off nearby electrical lines. Ho, ho, ho. Well, if you're ready for that, yes. And I have letters. I was corresponding with Phil in this time period. And I, so he actually claimed this. And so, you know who, of course, the chief atmospheric physicist at the University of Arizona at Tucson, the late Dr. James McDonald, you know who he was.
Yep.
A wonderful researcher. Mm-hmm. He was way beyond Hynek in his proper scientific and intellectual approach to this. And he tied into Phil Klass, and he said, look, fella, I'm the scientist that knows about atmospherics, and what you have proposed is absurd. And Phil Klass backed down like a little dog with his tail behind his between his legs, running off. And so then he says, well, okay, it was a hoax. That dynamite check was on the mayor's land, and he wanted to make a big tourist attraction. He wanted to use this as a tourist attraction, and blah, blah, blah. Well, the truth of the matter is, it was not the mayor's land. The truth of the matter is, irrelevant. Socorro never sought to promote this, never sought to get any kind of these silly conferences like those guys down in Texas are having, sensation things with everything from a carnival to people dressed up like fools and so on and so forth. No. Socorro never sought this, and the people there take this case with great seriousness to this day. There, you might encounter people who still believe it was a Black Project thing, but everybody takes this. I mean, the people you talk to, they all of them know that Lonnie was on the level and that this was real, and they know neighbors and people that heard this. And there were, by the way, Lonnie Zamora also knew another person that actually saw it as well in the landing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how has this thing... You know, we talked a little earlier about how it sort of changed, well, not sort of changed, it totally changed Lonnie Zamora's life. How has this changed your life?
Well, here's what it did to me. I had, way back in my, understand, I've been at this for 65 years, and I had been interested in it before that. I got interested at 9 years old, and I'm 76, figure out the years. But I got actively involved. I started an organization. I used to believe that these were Russian secret weapons. I'm talking about the late 40s. And then I read Donald Kehoe's first book, and then his second one, and it convinced me, okay, these have to be from somewhere other than the Earth. No idea from where, but from somewhere. Well, then I'm looking for an answer, and I got taken in by the hoaxes of George Adamski, which he subsequently, to his credit, confessed to me, and even took me into his so-called workshop and showed me where and how he faked his mothership photographs.
Really?
And tell me the whole story. I mean, a whole lot of it. And so I said,
podcast in itself.
Right. And I said to myself, my God, man, you know, you've got to get this at a level that communicates to science. And here's what I decided. You have to get electronic and optical equipment to monitor these things, to get hard data that speaks to physical scientists. You know, it's so absurd, these people that run around, oh, disclosure, disclosure. Well, Kehoe talked disclosure. Everybody and their dog is top disclosure, but it hasn't got anywhere because politicians are politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also controlled by money.
Oh, yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And it's absurd to look to politicians for an answer to this. By God, get out there with the instruments, as we have done. I've got stuff, if I can get you down here to see it. I can't talk the names of some of the high-level scientists that have seen this, but because I don't want to speak for them. But I can tell you, everybody knows that I have diagnostic faulty material. But if other people, the instruments that we put together, we had over $2 million in instruments and systems and facilities back in the 70s and into the 80s down in Texas. I still have here a recording gravimeter, recording magnetometer. They still work beautifully. I have spectrographic camera and other cameras, of course. But we went out there with that equipment. Today, you can get better equipment for less money.
Sure.
And as you know, Douglas Trumbull is mm-hmm. seemingly going the right direction, but my God, I feel sorry for the guy. Someone that I know, a wonderful person, wrote him and told him about my stuff, and he didn't even answer it. I can help him. I can show him the physics and the things, the instruments, exotic, specific things to look for with instruments that will give records viable, that will communicate to physical scientists. And I will quote one major, major scientist. This man was head of the, the School of Applied Science and Engineering of one of the most famous, highly esteemed universities in the world. And he saw just my first daylight color movie from an airliner, Squadco 77. Mm-hmm. And he said, look, your UFO researchers who live in a fantasy world may never, ever understand this. But he said, have no fear. Any scientist that has done research in applied plasma, particularly pulse plasma, will know immediately that you have filmed the most gigantic conceivable pulse plasma engine operating in the stratosphere. Everything is right. And this is the fact. Scientists seeing this, I'm ready. I mean, you have a link on your website where people can see my talk on dinosaur tracks and the new dinosaur species that I found that's down in the Smithsonian. Yes, but I am ready to ask them to let me show the best of this evidence there. You know why? Because it is the engineers and the physical scientists there who see this, and they understand this.
Are you talking about the Smithsonian?
I'm talking about Goddard Space Flight Center.
Oh, okay. You think they'd be open-minded enough?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
They don't have to be. They can be as closed-minded as they like. But by golly, most of them, when they see this, it's like this high-up scientist at this major thing, this major university told me. When they see it, they will know. This is not a matter of faith. When you see the physics, when I show you the physics, when I show you in broad daylight a disk with emitters around the rim, with a magnetic field that is causing the electrical emissions, which were under electromotive force, to be rotated by the Lorentz force, and you see the spiraling electrical fire around the object, you see it cause a tower with triangular objects to glow and project a beam, a narrow beam that looks like an electric rope spiraling out 30 diameters in front of it.
What Chris Lambright wrote in that book.
That's right. Descending. That's right. Mm-hmm. And he tells the whole story of how I gave this and how the aerospace, the major aerospace scientist that I gave this to, he said, Ray, now, and my wife, who you would never get an exaggeration of anything from her. She will tell you, she heard him say, I want to thank you. You have given your government today a quantum leap through the atmosphere and in space. And they went much further than that. And now they are testing things out in the boondocks of the Southwest that are related to this. And I can prove this. I have documents I can show that I got from him right here that I could not possibly have unless this whole story were true. And Chris checked into his entire background of every scientific paper he ever published and conclusively shows that he never had this idea until he talked to me. He came and talked to me because I had showed this to one of the guys who were working on a PhD under him that had been down at the University of Texas and before that at Rice University. And this fellow, I showed it to him right after I got the movie. And I said, God, I said, this is it. This is how come they can move through the atmosphere at hypersonic speed and never make a shockwave. They're electrifying there in front of them, moving out of the way, moving around them. In fact, effectively propulsion, a relative vacuum in front, compression in back, that's propulsion. But also, thus, you don't get any shockwave. And he said, I think you're right. Well, believe it or not, he had this guy come down. They were coming to the International Conference on Aerospace Advanced Propulsion at Goddard. He spent more time here that week with me than there. And let me tell you, the results have proven, as Chris shows in his book. But at the end, he said, you know, I wanted to come here because I have designed, and I can prove this, I can show you. If you'll come here, I'll show you the papers that prove it. He said, I've designed for the Air Force a spacecraft, magnetodynamically propelled, to take off without any fuel, powered by a beam from the ground, to go into orbit and come back down. But I said, you know what? He said, it's magnetodynamically propelled, just like the object that you filmed. But he said, we don't know how to land it.
Yeah.
because when we open the landing gear around the rim, and that plasma is swirling magnetodynamically, it will create chaos, and this could crash the thing, kill the pilots and everything else. I said, I know that, sir. I said, but you got to do what they do. Let me show you. And I showed him a picture of a drawing, multi-witness case. We're landing with arguments we're seeing in a tropical country in Central America. And I said, look here. The engineer, if it were aerodynamic, would put them out on the rim, but you can't because of the whirling of the magnetic, the plasma. You've got to put them in the magnetic vent where it's still, in the magnetic vent, out the bottom. Well, listen, my friend Scott called me 2 days later, and he said, Ray, I wish you could have seen it. When Professor and I got back up here at around 2:15, 2:30 the other morning from your place, he said he ran up the stairs to the electronic drafting machine, drew in the schema for the new landing gear placement, and sent it to Wright-Patterson immediately. Well, I will show you what he sent me then. Once he then put it into his presentation, the paper that 2 months later or so, he presented down at Goddard, downtown, at a major aerospace advanced propulsion conference. And he sent it to me because he delighted me. He had drawn the landing gear in exactly where I told him to put them. And he said, I thank you because we had no idea how to land this thing.
Wow. Well, Ray, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it today talking with you. That's it for the show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is Podcast UFO. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guests, Ray Stanford, Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for the Astronomy News, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Next week we have Sheila Aliens on, and we'll have Alejandro Rojas on. I'm excited about that, our new newscaster. And he's just going to help us out. He's still, of course, doing his thing over there at Open Minds. And don't forget to come back at 9 p.m. next week, Eastern Standard Time, and jump in the chat room at Podcast UFO. This is Martin Willis, reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.